Chapter 11. Liberal Guilt. We have now observed several instances of the cycle of enthusiastic idealism that propels modern democratic politics, as well as the lagging cycle of disappointment that invariably follows it. Both cycles are highly predictable given the economic desperation of ordinary Americans, and so is the next stage in the process, the transfer of this passionate idealism to Hillary Clinton. It is, as they say, her turn. After losing to Barack Obama in the Democratic primaries in 2008, she waited patiently for the years to pass, serving as his Secretary of State, doing good works with the Clinton Foundation, and now she gets both to run for the presidency and to be the vessel of liberal hopes. It is to her that we will all soon look for our salvation. As Hillary Clinton has no doubt noticed, the circumstances of 2016 present a striking similarity to the ones that put her husband in the White House in 1992. Again, Americans are outraged at the way the middle class is falling to pieces and at the greed of the people on top. The bestseller lists are once again filled with books about inequality. Today, Americans are working even harder for even less than when Bill Clinton made working harder for less his campaign catchphrase. The way Hillary Clinton, the way any Democrat, will play such a situation is extremely easy to guess. You see corporations making record profits, with CEOs making record pay, but your paychecks have barely budged, Hillary declared in June of 2015, launching her presidential campaign. Prosperity can't be just for CEOs and hedge fund managers. On she talked as the months rolled by, pronouncing in her careful way the rote denunciations of Wall Street that were supposed to make the crowds roar and the financiers tremble. That those financiers and hedge fund managers do not actually find Hillary's populism menacing is a well-established fact. Barack Obama's mild rebukes caused Wall Street to explode in fury and self-pity back in 2009 and 2010. The financiers pouted and cried and picked up their campaign donations and went home. But Hillary's comments provoked no such reaction. Only a few days before she launched her campaign, for example, John Mack, the former CEO of Morgan Stanley, was asked by a host on the Fox Business Channel whether her populist talk was causing him to reconsider his support for her. On the contrary, "To me, it's all politics," he responded. "It's trying to get elected, to get the nomination." "None of them think she really means her populism," wrote a prominent business journalist in 2014 about the bankers and Hillary. The Clinton Foundation has actually held meetings at the headquarters of Goldman Sachs, he points out. He quotes another Morgan Stanley officer who believes that, like her husband, Hillary will govern from the center and work to get things done and be capable of garnering support across different groups, including working with Republicans. How are the bankers so sure? Possibly because they've read the memoirs of Robert Rubin, the former chairman of Citibank, the former secretary of the Treasury, the former co-head of Goldman Sachs. One of the themes in this book is Rubin's constant war with the populists in the party and in the Clinton administration, a struggle in which Hillary was an important ally. Rubin tells how Hillary once helped him to get what he calls class-laden language deleted from a presidential speech, and also how she helped prevent the Democrats from appealing to class conflict in a general election, on the grounds that, quote, "it's not an effective approach to the swing voters in the middle of the electorate." Trying to figure out exactly where Hillary Clinton actually stands on political issues can be crazy-making. As a presidential candidate, for example, she says she deplores the revolving door between government and Wall Street because it destroys our trust in government, a noble sentiment. When she ran the State Department, however, that revolving door spun on a well-lubricated axis. As a presidential candidate, she opposes Obama's Trans-Pacific Partnership Treaty, as do I. As Secretary of State, however, she helped to negotiate it. As a presidential candidate in 2008, she claimed to oppose NAFTA, the first great triumph of the Bill Clinton administration. Not only had she supported it earlier, but as a U.S. senator, she voted for numerous Bush administration free trade treaties. The same is true nearly everywhere you look. The great imprisonment mania of the 1990s, for example. As First Lady, Hillary's appetite to incarcerate was unassuageable. "We need more and tougher prison sentences for repeat offenders," she said in 1994, kicking off a bloodthirsty call for more three strikes laws. On another day, 7 years later, Senator Hillary Clinton could be found urging law students to, quote, "dare to care about the 1.5 million children who have a parent in jail." Even the well-being of poor women and children, Hillary's great signature issue in her youth, had to hit the bricks when the time arrived in 1996 for welfare reform, a measure she not only supported, but for which she says she lobbied. As a presidential candidate in 2008, Hillary liked to identify herself with working-class middle Americans. As a lawyer in Arkansas in the 80s, however, she was a proud member of the board of directors of Walmart, the retailer that has acted on middle America like a neutron bomb. As a student leader in the 60s, she opposed the Vietnam War. As a senator in the Bush years, she voted for the Iraq War. As a presidential candidate, she has now returned to her roots and acknowledges that vote was wrong. On the increasingly fraught matter of the sharing economy, the battle of Silicon Valley and Uber versus the workers of the world, Hillary actually tried to have it both ways in the same speech in July 2015. She first said she approved of how these new developments were unleashing innovation, but also allowed that she worried about the hard questions they raised. And that was tepid, but it was not tepid enough. Republicans pounced. They harbored no reservations at all about innovation, they said. Hillary's chief technology officer was forced to double down on her employer's wishy-wash. "Sharing economy firms are disrupting traditional industries for the better across the globe," she wrote. But workers still needed to be protected. This dutiful inhabitant of Hillary land then rushed to remind what she called the tech community of the ties that bound them to the Democrats. Immigration, environment, and gay marriage. Republicans? Ugh. "Very few technologists I know stand with them," she wrote. Times change. Politicians compromise. Neither is a sin. The way Hillary herself puts it is that while her principles never waver, I do absorb new information. Still, her combination is unique. She is politically capricious, and yet, as we shall see, she maintains an image of rock-solid moral commitment. How these two coexist is the mystery of Hillary Rodham Clinton. I'm good, I'm good, I'm good. The one thing about Hillary that everyone knows and on which everyone agrees is how smart she is. She's an accomplished professional, a brilliant leader of a brilliant generation, a woman of obvious intelligence. Rather than investigate her record, biographies of Hillary Clinton often read like high-achieving resumes. They tell us about her accomplishments in high school in the Chicago suburbs, how she was student body president at Wellesley College, what she said in her bold graduation speech in 1969, and how that speech was covered by Life magazine, which was in turn excited by the top students around the country who were rebelling even as they graduated. Then, the fine law schools into which Hillary was accepted, her deeds at the Yale Law Review, how she made the short list of lawyers invited to work on the Nixon impeachment inquiry, and how she could easily have bagged a partnership at a prestigious law firm, but, in a risky gambit marveled at by everyone who writes about her, how she chose instead to move to Arkansas and join forces with that other prominent leader of the 60s generation, Bill Clinton, who had managed to compile an impressive resume in his own right. Her biographers write about Hillary this way because her successes in the upper reaches of the meritocracy are what make her a leader. Indeed, Hillary talks this way herself. In 2001, when she was a U.S. senator from New York, she was still telling the story of how she made the hard choice between Yale and Harvard law schools. The theme of her 2008 presidential campaign was opening the most important job in the world to talent. As Secretary of State in the Obama years, she repeated many times her belief that, quote, talent is universal, but opportunity is not. It's her motto, her credo, her innermost faith, that smart people are born free, but everywhere they are in chains, prevented by unfair systems from rising to the top. Meritocracy is who she is. The other persistent refrain in accounts of Hillary Clinton's life is her dedication to high principle. Again, all her biographers agree on this. Everyone knows it is true. The way Hillary negotiates between high-minded principle and the practical demands of the world is a theme that weaves itself into her story, just as growth and self-actualization flavor biographies of her husband. It comes naturally to everyone who thinks about her, and it has since the very beginning, since her college commencement speech in 1969 rebuked those who thought of politics as the art of the possible rather than the art of making what appears to be impossible possible. Hillary always knew what was right, declares biographer Gail Sheehy. Over the long haul, observes biographer David Brock, she had no intention of conceding the substantive issues or bedrock principles to the other side. Her 2008 campaign advisor, Ann Lewis, once described Hillary's political philosophy with this inspirational poster favorite. Do all the good you can, by all the means you can, in all the ways you can, in all the places you can, at all the times you can, to all the people you can, as long as ever you can. Hillary's ambition was always to do good on a huge scale, writes biographer Carl Bernstein of her college years. And her nascent instinct, so visible at Wellesley, to mediate principle with pragmatism, without abandoning basic beliefs, seemed a powerful and plausible way of achieving it. Now that is some slippery stuff right there. But you get the feeling that Bernstein is doing his best. After all, describing someone's ambition to do good on a huge scale is like analyzing the harmonies of the spheres. It's not easy. And it gets even less easy when Bernstein's heroine goes to Yale Law School. There, the journalist writes, she was a recognizable star on campus, much discussed among the law school's students, known as politically ambitious, practical, and highly principled. As First Lady in the 1990s, Hillary Clinton went on to enthuse about some respectable something called the politics of meaning, and was profiled in the New York Times magazine as Saint Hillary, a woman who would like to do good on a grand scale, and she would like others to do good as well. In a presidential primary debate in 2015, she announced, "I'm not taking a back seat to anybody on my values and my principles." If you're like me, all this talk of rock-solid principles makes you immediately wonder what those principles are. Young Hillary was known for them, we read. She had no intention of ever conceding them. She takes second place to nobody in honoring them. But what they actually were is always left unspoken. The politics of meaning, yes, we remember hearing that phrase, but meaning what? What did it all mean? No ceilings. Nothing is more characteristic of the liberal class than its members' sense of their own elevated goodness. It's a feeling that overrides any particular inconsistency or policy failing. The lousy deeds of Bill Clinton, for example, do not reduce his status in this value system. Still, it's not merely the shrill self-righteousness that conservatives love to deplore. Nor is it simply the air of militant politeness you encounter in places like Boston or Bethesda. It's more rarefied than that, a combination of virtue and pedigree, a matter of educational accomplishment, of taste, of status, of professionalism. When this value system judges Hillary to be a woman of high idealism, what is being referenced might more accurately be called the atmosphere of acute virtue, of pure, serene, alpine propriety, through which her campaign and indeed her person seems to move at all times. I myself got a whiff of this intoxicating stuff on International Women's Day in March 2015 when I attended a Clinton Foundation production at the Best Buy Theater in New York City called No Ceilings. The happening I am describing wasn't a campaign event. The presidential race had not started at that point. Nor was it a panel discussion, as there were no disagreements among participants or questions from the audience. Instead, it was a choreographed presentation of various findings having to do with women's standing in the world. But if you paid attention, it provided a way to understand Hillary's genuine views on the great social question before the nation, the problem of income inequality. Onto the stage before us came Hillary Clinton, the Democratic Party's heiress apparent, Melinda Gates, the wife of the richest man in the world. The event was a co-production with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Various foundation executives, a Hollywood celebrity, a Silicon Valley CEO, a best-selling author, an expert from Georgetown University, a Nobel Prize winner, and a large supporting cast of women from around the Third World. Everyone strode with polished informality about the stage, reading their lines from an invisible teleprompter. Back and forth, the presenters called out to one another in tones of gracious supportiveness and flattery so sweet it bordered on idolatry. In her introduction to the event, for example, the TV star America Ferrera, who has appeared at many Clinton events, both philanthropic and political, gave a shout out to, quote, the incredible women who have brought us all here today, and the, quote, amazing girls whose conversation she had been permitted to join. Then Chelsea Clinton, who announced herself, quote, completely awed by the incredible swell of people and partners who had participated in some event the previous day, invited us to hearken to, quote, the inspiring voices of leaders, of communities, of companies, of countries. Those were just the first few minutes of the event. It kept on like that for hours. When someone's potential was mentioned, it was described as boundless. People's stories were compelling when they weren't inspiring or incredible or incredibly inspiring. A Kenyan activist was introduced as the incomparable. A man thanked Hillary Clinton for her leadership, and Hillary Clinton in turn thanked someone for saying that women were harmed more by climate change than were men. The real star of this show was the creative innovator, the figure who crops up whenever the liberal class gets together to talk about spreading the prosperity around more fairly. In this case, the innovations being hailed were mainly transpiring in the Third World. Quote, every year, millions and millions of women everywhere are empowering themselves and their communities by finding unique, dynamic, and productive ways to enter the workforce, start their own businesses, and contribute to their economies and their countries, said Chelsea Clinton, introducing a, quote, inspiring innovator and chocolatier from Trinidad. Melinda Gates followed up the chocolatier's presentation by heaping up even more praise. Quote, she was an amazing businesswoman. You can see why we all find her so inspiring. Then, a little later on, quote, entrepreneurship is really vital to women. It's also their ability to advance into leadership roles in corporations. And corporations play such a big role in the global economy. They certainly do. The presence of Melinda Gates should probably have been a clue, but still I was surprised when the rhetoric of idealistic affirmation expanded to cover technology, meaning social media. Participants described it as one of the greatest liberators of humanity ever conceived. Do I exaggerate? Not really. Here again, the words of America Ferrera. Quote, we're hearing these stories for the first time because of a new thing called social media. 20 years ago, in many communities across the world, women and girls were often virtually silenced, with no outlet and no resources to raise their voices and with it themselves. And that's huge. 1 out of every 2 people, 50% of the world's population, without a voice. Social media is a new tool to amplify our voices. No matter which platform you prefer, social media has given us all an extraordinary new world where anyone, no matter their gender, can share their story across communities, continents, and computer screens. A whole new world without ceilings. Techno-ecstatic was the term I used to describe rhetoric like this during the 1990s, and now, two crashes and countless tech scandals later, here it was, its claims of freedom through smartphones, undimmed and unmodified. This form of idealism had survived everything: mass surveillance, inequality, the gig economy. Nothing could dent it. Roughly speaking, there were two groups present at this distinctly first world gathering: hard-working women of color and authoritative women of whiteness. Many of the people making presentations came from third world countries: a midwife from Haiti, a student from Afghanistan, the chocolate maker from Trinidad, a former child bride from India, an environmental activist from Kenya. While the women anchoring this swirling praise fest were former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and the wealthy foundation executive Melinda Gates. What this event suggested is that there is a kind of naturally occurring solidarity between the millions of women at the bottom of the world's pyramid and the tiny handful of women at its very top. The hardship those third world women have endured and the entrepreneurial efforts they have undertaken are powerful symbols of the struggle of American professional women to become CEOs of Fortune 500 companies, one of the ambitions that was discussed in detail at the event, or of a woman to be elected president.